The effect on the United Nations was devastating. In its wake, the UN began to cut its presence from 800 international staffers to 15. This was significant because the UN had served as a bridge for the Americans to important Shiite leaders, such as Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, who wouldn't meet directly with U.S. occupation officials. The act was successful in that it convinced the organization that continuing to operate in Iraq would be too costly. Marine Colonel T.X. Hams, the Marine expert on counterinsurgency who worked for the CPA on the training of Iraqis in the winter of 2003-04, later wrote in assessing the insurgent strategy. Other international organizations, such as the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the British relief agency Oxfam, began to pull out in the following weeks. After the UN was hit again with a smaller bomb a month later, more staffers and other agencies, such as Save the Children UK, left Iraq. "That was a brilliant campaign," said Hams. "They hit the UN, the Red Cross, the Jordanian embassy, and the Iraqi police. And we were calling them dead-enders? Who do you think is disorganized at that point?" Out in Anbar province, Keith Mines also felt the increasing heat. "The level of animosity toward the coalition appears to be rising in Al-Anbar province, as both quantitatively there is an increasing rage on the streets, and qualitatively the attacks are growing more sophisticated and bolder," he wrote in his weekly report of September 24. "Only a small minority of Al-Anbarians are taking up arms against the coalition, but the vast middle ground does nothing to stop them, and to date does not see it in their interest to help us corner them, and the trends are moving in the wrong direction." Mines also wrote to his family that he was worried about the volatile combination he saw brewing in his province. "Hordes of mad young men with too much time on their hands and too many weapons readily available. Some of them were learning how to make and deliver bombs. The enemy may not have had a public face, but he certainly was developing a distinctive mode of attack." Each war produces its own artifacts, its distinctive phrases, garments, or technological innovations. The memorable piece of clothing from World War I was the trench coat, which captures a key aspect of that mired conflict. The classic abbreviation of World War II was SNAFU, situation normal, all fucked up. More than anything else, war is about destruction, and so it is weaponry that most often captures the feel of a given conflict. The cold soul of the limited 1991 Gulf War was the precision-guided smart bomb, which distilled to one lethal device the technological leap the U.S. military had taken since the end of the Vietnam War just 16 years earlier. The emblematic weapon of the new Iraq War was quite the opposite, the inexpensive, low-tech roadside bomb. The U.S. military called it the IED, for improvised explosive device. In unhappy contrast to the earlier U.S. war with Iraq, this weapon was used not by, but against U.S. forces. It quickly became the single greatest threat to them. About one-third of U.S. troops killed in the first year of the insurgency were victims of these bombs, as were about two-thirds of those wounded severely enough to require medical evacuation out of Iraq. Support troops, such as mechanics and supply specialists, were most vulnerable, accounting for three-quarters of those killed by the bombs in the summer of 2003. Even these fairly primitive devices had their own evolution. At first, during the summer of 2003, almost all were hardwired, that is, attached to the lines used to detonate them. U.S. forces learned to look for the wire and kill the person waiting at the other end. By the following winter, about half the bombs were remote-controlled, frequently set off using cellular telephones, car alarm transmitters, or toy car controllers. For charges, insurgents usually used 155mm artillery shells and a variety of mortar rounds, and occasionally TNT or a plastic explosive. The bombs at first were concealed under rocks or piles of trash, which were everywhere along Baghdad streets, as social services failed to resume after the war. Others were hidden in the carcasses of dead dogs, which, in the humid summer heat of Iraq, produced a putrid smell that would deter all but the most dedicated soldier from probing for bombs. Early on, one favored tactic was to block the road with a truck or bus that would appear to be stalled or broken down, and then plant a series of bombs behind the vehicle in the area along the road where the U.S. convoy would be forced to stop. U.S. troops responded by driving up on the sidewalk or in the incoming lane of traffic, which got them out of the trap, but inadvertently served the insurgents' secondary purpose of angering and alienating Iraqis who had to scramble out of the way of the careening convoy.